for extinction! Burn, fuckers!
See, here's my theory, okay? Look, if we want to knock people on their asses, then we've got to give them a show. The punks, they're doing the minimalist thing, so let's take it in the exact opposite direction. I'm talking a stadium show in the clubs, man. Like costumes and lights and pyro, flames and shit.
Exactly.
Explosions. Exactly. Look, it's a fucking war out there. And the only way we win is by showing these kids something they've never seen before.
Hello, you're listening to Rock and or Roll. I'm BJ, and finally, it's over. This is it, the last episode in the Motley Crue series. And the lucky guy that gets to join me for this episode is Mr. Craig Cohen, friend of the show, Craig Cohen. Hey, Craig.
Hey, BJ. This is, I gotta say, there's a lot of pressure involved here because over the course of this series, you've had some amazing guests that have provided hours of amazing entertainment talking about Motley Crue. So big shoes to fill here.
You got any fat jokes about Vince Neil? Get them out of the way now.
Oh, yeah. It's funny. I went this morning. I went to go get bagels like I do every Saturday morning. And the bagel place I go to is right next to Vince's restaurant here in Las Vegas. So every Saturday morning, I see Vince's big mug on the billboard above it.
And he lives there, right?
Yeah, I actually met Vince out in the wild at my job. I was coming back from the food court, and I see this just big blonde hair bopping through the casino. And I said, that looks like Vince Neil. And I sped up a little bit and got next to him, and sure enough, it was Vince. And as big of a piece of shit as Vince is, I couldn't help myself, and I stopped him and said hi to him, and we talked for a couple minutes, and he was really gracious and upbeat. It's also funny, we're recording this on Memorial Day weekend. It's funny that 6 years ago this weekend, me and my brother saw Motley Crue in Atlantic City on whatever tour they were doing. I mean, they were just touring at that point. The tour, they weren't supporting anything, and they put on a really good show. I mean, they get a lot of help live, but I can't imagine people walk away from those shows or walked away from those shows not feeling like they got their money's worth.
Yeah, I've never seen them live, and after like the early 80s, I wouldn't really have any interest in seeing them live. I wouldn't expect it to be a good show, but maybe.
Well, it's just it's all smoke and mirrors, right? You know, yeah. they've got like however many backup singers and dancers and, you know, Kiss level pyro, and you know, you've got Tommy doing the ridiculous roller coaster drum solo. I mean, it's a spectacle. It's a circus, right? Didn't they put out a DVD that had circus in the title? So
yeah, probably.
You know, you're not going to see like a legitimate rock show, if you will. But we had a good time. I mean, it was a good show.
I mean, I remember when they came through Alpine Valley on the Dr. Feelgood tour when I was in high school, and I just wasn't really a fan and had no interest in going. I went to a lot of other bands at Alpine Valley, but I just didn't care about going to see Motley Crue.
Is it weird to think that like Dr. Feelgood was really like the end for Motley Crue, and then they wrote it for almost another 25 years?
Yeah, it's nuts. I mean, that's what kind of the theme that has arisen from doing this series is that I don't think they're a very good band. You know, I love their first album, and I like their second album a lot. And then after that, there's a few songs that I like, basically. But, you know, I just don't think they're... My personal opinion is they're not very good.
Do you think it was just the push they got? And I know, like, on the 1994 album, you kind of talked about how, you know, Nicky had a huge falling out with MTV, and it adversely affected the promotion they did for that album. But do you think that Motley Crue was just a band that was sort of carried by MTV?
Yeah. I mean, Shout at the Devil was a good record, but then, you know, Theater of Pain just revolved around that cover song and that ballad, and otherwise they had nothing to offer. And yeah, they got tons of airplay for, you know, the Girls, Girls, Girls video. And then somehow, can't comprehend how the song Dr. Feelgood was a big hit. That just, I don't understand. We learned doing this that Without You was actually a top 10 single, which I would have never guessed from my memory of it. But that must have been, that's like a top 40 radio thing. Not even rock radio, probably.
Dr. Feelgood, I remember, I was in high school when that came out. And I remember, I wasn't a huge like Motley Crue fan. My brother had the album, so I would listen to him, you know, through him. But I remember that was like a big deal. I mean, I remember like, you know, the hype surrounding the Dr. Feelgood video coming out, and there was a lot of hype surrounding it. I mean, that was a time when, you know, any album coming out, you know, was getting hyped. And I mean, that really shows the power of MTV. But yeah, I mean, that album feels like it was around forever too. And that's what makes 94 feel so weird, because there was so much time between it too.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I've often, you know, had this theory, BJ, that like the worst thing that can happen to a band is success.
Yeah.
And I think Motley Crue is a perfect example of that, because I think once you get money and fame and whatever else you've been trying to get out of being in a band, you just lose the things that made you able to write great songs or made you hungry to actually give a shit.
Yeah, for sure. Nikki Sixx was hungry when he wrote Too Fast for Love and Shout at the Devil. And then basically after that, you know, the next two records, he was just a junkie trying to pull something out of his ass so they could put a record out. And then Dr. Feelgood, you know, they're clean and sober. But in my opinion, Bob Rock, he made a record that wasn't really a Motley Crue record. He kind of, you know, I think part of what Dr. Feelgood was a conforming to the kind of music that was popular at the time, like helping them fit in with the Warrants and the Wingers. And yeah, so Dr. Feelgood to me doesn't really sound like Motley Crue. It just sounds like a generic band of that ilk.
Yeah. Well, Bob Rock is sort of that kind of producer, right? He's like a Bob Ezrin or something, where when you sign him on, you're kind of giving up a little bit of your identity, because all of a sudden they become a fifth or sixth member of the band.
And one thing I have to admit about the 94 album, you know, even though I don't like it because of the style of the music, it sounds really good. The guitars on that record sound great. You know, I think it sounds better than Dr. Feelgood. And, it's good heavy guitar sound. So, you know, he did a good job on that record, I guess. But, you know, I don't like the style of music they were doing for the most part.
Well, and I know you talked about it, you know, plenty, but like, Yeah, I mean, when you've got 6 and 7 minute long songs, it's just, it's really hard.
Yeah. Well, I love the theory that the reason they're so long is just because they slowed them down.
Yeah.
They wrote them at a normal pace, but then they're like, oh, this is alternative. So alternative means slower. So, and then they end up long. And, you know, yeah. Generation Swine. It's like, they're every song is chasing a different trend. It's like, it's really.
Well, and it's a weird album too, because they, you know, they started making it with Karabi and then bring Vince back. So it's got like, it's got even less identity because of that. Like, you know, because Vince is such a different singer and had such a different approach than Karabi that like you get this weird sort of hybrid.
Yeah, that's true. And so much input from Tommy, I think, on that record.
Yeah, and how long was it after Generation Swine that Tommy just finally went off and did the method, you know, Methods of Mayhem, and was pretty much done with the band?
Yeah, it was maybe the next year. Was it in? So Generation Swine's in '97, right? And then February of '98, you know. A fight over a frying pan escalated into Tommy Lee going to jail for 3 months and getting divorced from Pamela Anderson.
Oh, my goodness.
He couldn't find a frying pan to make stir fry. And it escalated into this big brouhaha that, you know, culminated in him ending up in jail. Of course, the reason he went to jail is because of his previous infractions or, you know, his laundry list, his, you know, rap sheet.
Is it physical abuse to do what you've done to Pamela?
Absolutely. Absolutely. No one should be treated that way. Nobody.
Why would you do that? I mean, what was it about your anger that would make you lash out physically?
Just not having the techniques to not let that happen. It's a lot of pressure. We've been going through a lot of stuff. So now, sex tapes appearing, old boyfriend sex tapes appearing, new children, postpartum, my frustration, two new babies. Tommy comes third now instead of first. I'm a new father. I don't know how to deal with that. That's a first for me, too. Just start stacking them all up. And you got a guy who really, the whole argument stemmed that evening from me wanting some love. You got two people in two pretty crazy lifestyles trying to be the best parents they can and also remain lovers and best friends.
These years between Generation Swine to New Tattoo to Saints of Los Angeles, it's just a long list of arrests and lawsuits. It's fucking crazy. All these misdemeanor arrests. All the guys, well, not Mick Mars, but the rest of them just keep getting arrested and sued and suing people. And it's really, what a mess.
Well, and like, it feels like there was a period where like Vince was getting pulled over for DWIs like every 2 weeks. And I've had this theory like that when you make a certain amount of money, there's like two things you should do. Like never leave the house after 2 a.m. and get a driver. Like it shouldn't be that hard.
There's other things in life than just, you know, drugs and alcohol.
A week after saying he was sober, Motley Crue singer Vince Neil was arrested on drunken driving charges. The 49-year-old rocker was pulled over by police in his Lamborghini near the Las Vegas Strip. Authorities say he was taken into custody late Sunday night and then released the following day after posting $2,000 bail. Neil said he hadn't used drugs in 20 years and had stopped abusing alcohol.
Well, I mean, there's a, you know, point in your life where you just, you know, you just kind of stop. You know, that's what happened with me. And that was like 3 years ago.
Yeah, Vince, you know, what a mess. But, you know, this Tommy Lee, Pamela Anderson thing, he went to jail. They got divorced. Then he gets out of jail. They get back together. They get re-engaged. They're going to get married on Valentine's Day. He's in Europe promoting Methods of Mayhem, which, holy shit, is that some horrible shit. And she tells him over the phone that she's breaking up with him again. Then they get back together again at some point. I mean, they got back together like three different times. But then they finally broke up when she hooked up with Kid Rock. So they broke up for good.
You hated Kid Rock, though.
He's kind of a punk.
Really?
He's kind of a punk ass. Yeah.
Could you Why do you say that?
Could you kick his ass?
I don't know. He's just, something about him isn't very cool.
Really?
Really? Because he was bad-mouthing you.
I never paid much attention, so I don't know. Just his attitude, you know, just kind of a punk.
Did he come to you and say, hey, Tommy, I want to go out with your ex-wife? Did he ask permission?
No. He gave me the courtesy call.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, that was good.
What'd he say?
Hey, by the way, dude.
I'm banging.
Yeah, some things happened, you know, in New York. And I was like, thanks for the call, dude. That's tight. Later. Okay, ass.
The right thing to do would have been to call you and say, I'm having feelings about her. Is it okay if I date your ex-wife? And then if you said no, then he walks away.
But I know one thing Tommy Lee said is he was never going to get back together with her again after she sent him to jail for the second time. But they did reunite after that. So.
Sent him to jail. That's so funny.
Like, yeah. I mean,
it just shows the mentality behind that.
One of the reasons they got back together is because he was really there for her when she had her breast implants removed. Oh, and they had a horrible custody battle too over those kids.
Yeah, and then what? One of them ended up beating Tommy up a couple years ago.
Yeah, the Tommy Lee Pamela Anderson saga is just stupid. And yeah, I guess it was when he was in jail for 3 months that when he came out of jail, that's when he quit Motley Crue and started doing his own thing.
And yeah, like, wasn't he writing Methods of Mayhem material while he was in jail?
Probably.
Like, I remember reading an interview probably around the time that, like, he said that that's how he spent his time, like, just writing songs in his head, I guess.
Yeah, he tried to jump onto the nu metal bandwagon there. When Tommy left the band, they replaced him with Randy Castillo.
Tremendous drummer.
Yeah.
You know, you could almost argue, if not a lateral replacement, an upgrade. I mean, Tommy, had different levels of drum prowess over the years. And it's funny when you talk to drummers, and I think you guys addressed this on earlier episodes, you know, the idea that for a long time, Tommy was really considered like one of the, you know, marquee drummers. And that as time has gone on, he's kind of, that idea has kind of gone away. And I still think he's a fun drummer to listen to. But I think one of the highlights of the new Tattoo album is sort of the energy that Randy Castillo brings to it.
Yeah. So New Tattoo came out in 2000. And who is this James Michael guy that co-wrote a bunch of the songs? Do you know who that is?
He ended up doing 6 a.m. with Nikki and DJ Ashba.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And this is before 6 a.m. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And I got to say that, you know, I think depending on who you talk to and how long you want to debate it, I would say that this is probably their third or fourth best album.
Well, I guess if you say so.
Well, I mean, okay, you're gonna rank the first two albums, one and two, depending on what order you like them in. But after that, I mean, New Tattoo's better than Theater of Pain and Girls, Girls, Girls. It's debatable on whether or not it's better than Dr. Feelgood. And it's better than 94 and Generation Swine.
I probably like Girls, Girls, Girls more. I especially like the first three songs on that record a lot. And then I like You're All I Need. So, but yeah, there's some really bad stuff on there too. But yeah, you're right. I mean, Theater of Pain has almost nothing to offer, and I'm not much of a fan of Dr. Feelgood. I love Don't Go Away Mad, but it's better than Generation Swine. Sorry, Joey.
Well, at least the thing here that it seems to me like on New Tattoo, they were at least focused again, or at least focused on making an album that sounded like Motley Crue.
Come on.
you know, there was kind of a revival of like sleaze metal kind of sound in the late 90s, early 2000s. And so around the time this album came out, there were a lot of like younger bands doing it better, like the Backyard Babies and stuff. So, you know, I would just listen to that instead. But
yeah, I don't know. I think the thing is, you've got like the two songs on here, you know, the title track and then Hollywood Ending, that are almost interchangeable. But aside from that, I mean, I really like, you know, how driving all the songs are. And I know on the past episodes you talked about how like Tommy's drumming, you know, sort of, you know, moved away from like driving the song. And that's the thing I really like about this new Tattoo album, is at least it's got energy. It feels like they give a shit for the first time in a while.
Yeah, it's definitely mostly back to a more straightforward rock and roll sound.
Hell on High Heels is a great chorus. You know, I think Dragstrip Superstars is a great song.
Those are probably the two best songs, the two you just named. First Band on the Moon has a great chorus. Such a dumb name.
Yeah. But I also like She Needs Rock and Roll sort of has like this Beatles via Enough's Enough kind of feel to it, which I really like. I like I said, I would rank this, you know, third or fourth if I was ranking all the albums.
Oh, what did I read about the album cover?
Oh, it was a riff on a Bruce Dickinson's.
Oh, yeah, because Tattooed Millionaire is supposedly about Nikki fucking Bruce's wife, right?
Yes.
So they made fun of that with their album cover, right? That's pretty funny. Yeah.
Well, it's funny. I guess Nikki talked about that in The Dirt. And do you think The Dirt sort of saved Motley Crue's legacy or helped cement them or make them memorable? Or do you think it helped make them, you know, prevent them from just becoming that forgotten band from the 80s?
Yeah, I think it did. And it also like it got to the point where all of a sudden, like Rolling Stone would pay attention to Motley Crue, where they wouldn't really have, you know, shown them much respect before. But it's like everybody was acting like this was such a great book. I mean, it is a fun book to read, but
and they had to be writing this right around the time that they did or like right after New Tattoo, because the book came out in 2001.
Yeah.
So that's weird. Was Tommy even in the band when they were writing the book?
Huh. Yeah, you're right. I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and the guy they wrote it with was from Rolling Stone, right?
Neil Strauss. Yeah. Well, it just feels weird. I mean, it almost feels like The Dirt was, I mean, after New Tattoo, they do The Dirt in 2001, and then Nicky goes off and does, what, The Heroin Diaries and 6 a.m. and all that. But that's quite a few years down the road. And then they don't do anything again until Saints of Los Angeles, which is, you know, kind of the audio version of The Dirt years before the Netflix movie. So it almost feels like New Tattoo really kind of ended them as a, you know, an active band, because after The Dirt, were they just touring a lot at that point?
Yeah, and they had, well, I guess the greatest hits with Bitter Pill came out before New Tattoo, right?
Yeah, because Tommy promoted that.
But then they were putting out, like, compilations and box sets and just pumping out, you know, other shit.
They've got so many. It's funny. I opened up my my music player the other day, Google Play Music, and it's, you know, I looked up Motley Crue to listen to one of the albums, and it said there were 45 Motley Crue albums in the collection. So between compilations and live albums and, you know, now The Dirt is just basically another repackage with a three new songs or whatever.
Well, If I Die Tomorrow, that came out after New Tattoo, right?
Oh yeah, that was on a Greatest Hits too, wasn't it?
Probably. I hate that song so much. That's so such shit.
It's basically 6 a.m., right?
Yeah. I think a guy from Blink-182 wrote that song, right?
Let me see. It came out in 2005.
That song is so weak.
Oh, it was on Red, White, and Crew.
Yeah. Yeah, Greatest Hits.
And Tommy was back for that. Oh, it was originally written by the Canadian pop punk band Simple Plan.
Oh.
And it was left off their 2004 album.
Yeah, it still was not a getting Simple Plan song. Outtake. Oh, it's such shit.
Oh, do you know in 2014, Florida Georgia Line covered it?
Oh my God.
There's a tribute to Motley Crue called Nashville Outlaws, a tribute to Motley Crue.
Holy shit.
Which has, let's see, Kickstart My Heart by Rascal Flatts.
What the fuck?
Smoking in the Boys Room by Leanne Rimes. Let's see, Same Old Situation by Big and Rich.
Jesus Christ.
Time for a Change by Darius Rucker.
Oh my God. Sounds like the worst thing ever.
It started, Chris Nielsen and our management company got a hold of Scott and with Big Machine and said, what would you think of doing a tribute? Hadn't even talked to Motley yet. I got this weird idea about doing a tribute album, country tribute album. He just goes, done. I want to do this. I want to talk to the band, make sure they're into it, because this is a big leap. And we sit down and talked about it, and we're like, oh, wow, okay. Because we get it, because a lot of 80s rock fans are now new country music fans and vice versa. And we never even thought about it. And then the more we started talking to Scott and talking about the artists and how they loved the band, it became really organic. And now we're sitting here today and this album's done, and it's kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah, I mean, seeing some of the bands, you know, before they recorded, you know, like Florida Georgia Line, you know, a rock and roll band. You know, even Rascal Flatts got a lot of rock and roll in him, so after, like, you know, hearing and seeing these bands, it was like, yeah, of course it just really makes sense, because a lot of these, you know, the new country is rock and roll.
Yeah, you know, it makes sense on a lot of levels. Not only is it a record for country fans who are rock fans, and we don't think we really have a record that was made just for Motley Crue fans or rock fans, but we think that there is that crossing moment, and when you have great songs, it's going to be the first single with Justin Moore and Vince's on it. A lot of people are going to connect to that and go listen to the record and go be as surprised as we were, you know, being in awe. I mean, isn't that the idea behind music? You're just like, wow, I didn't see that coming. Motley Crue's been the first on so many things, and we've taken a lot of bricks in the face over the years, and people are like going, you know, what are you doing? What are you thinking? And then it becomes successful. The Vegas residency was one of those. People are like, you know, there's no way. It looks like that's where bands go to die, and now every band is doing Vegas residencies. And if you back up all the way to our first album, we were always doing stuff like that, changing our logos, our image, our sound, and in a sense, this is, you know, in that tradition.
There's really no young rock and rollers out there, I really see. I mean, I think Nikki sees a lot more than I do because she's got your station, you're more.
There's a few, but not like it used to be.
But like with the younger country people, it's just, you know, they got the heavy guitars in it now, but along with banjo, you know, and big bass, but also with a slide guitar. You know, it's a little bit of everything. And I brought up Florida Georgia Line earlier, and like, you know, you go out there and their guitar player's got mohawk and tattoos, and it's cool. It's rock and roll, but just in a little different way.
They were no longer even under, they didn't have any formal record contract after Elektra gave them their masters back, right?
Yeah, they somehow managed to get the rights back to all their records when they left Elektra, which, I mean, Elektra had been trying to get rid of them for a while. I guess they were just like, here, whatever you want, just go. Just leave us alone.
Yeah, well, it's just weird because you wonder, like, why Saints of Los Angeles happened.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, since they were going to call it The Dirt, and, you know, they had been trying to make that movie since, what, like 2004? Like, at one point, Johnny Knoxville was going to be in the movie.
Well, yeah, I mean, the guy that ended up directing it for Netflix was Jeff Tremaine, who is like kind of the guy behind the scenes from Jackass. But yeah, I mean, there was talk for a long time about The Dirt being like a legitimate theatrical release.
Yeah.
So I guess this was probably, but that's what's, it makes it even weirder that they didn't call the album The Dirt, because if you listen to it, it's pretty much just like all songs inspired by them being a young, hungry band, and then what happens when you get successful.
Yeah, it's basically a concept album telling the story of Motley Crue.
It's hard not to turn it off after that first song, that LAMF. It's just really, it's really hard to take seriously.
Yeah. Yeah, so you know, The Dirt came out in May of 2001, and then in June of 2001, that four-year-old kid drowned in Tommy Lee's swimming pool.
Oh, terrible. Yeah, it was at one of his kids' birthday parties or something, right?
Yeah.
Oof.
Yeah,
so
it was
tragic.
It was the son of a TV actor named James Varis. Yeah, there were 15 kids at the... It was Brandon's birthday party, I guess. Yeah, the parents weren't there. They left their son in the care of his male nanny, who in turn asked a preschool teacher to watch the child so he could leave to attend the Wango Tango concert at nearby Dodgers Stadium.
Oh,
featuring
no.
Ricky Martin, Will Smith, Britney Spears, UB40, and Blondie.
Oh, what a terrible story.
Yeah. And then that guy, Christian Weiss, was the babysitter that was supposed to be watching him and went to the concert, and he fled the United States for Germany.
Wow.
And then, of course, they sued Tommy Lee.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's kind of funny, BJ. I've during this series, I've talked with, you know, people I know a lot about Motley Crue, and it's so funny that, or it's really sad that, you know, all four original Ramones are dead, but all four members of Motley Crue are still walking the earth.
Yeah, right.
You know, like, what did Joey Ramone ever do to anybody? And, you know, and he's dead, and Vince is still walking around with, you know, permanently disabled people. He killed somebody. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just proof that life really isn't fair.
I know, poor Joey. Yeah, that's why I hate the concept of karma, because it does not exist. Because you can cite many, many examples of karma not working correctly. Speaking of which, in May of 2002, Randy Castillo died, even though, you know, they thought that his treatment for his cancer had worked. They, you know, he thought he had beaten it. I think he died kind of suddenly.
Well, he didn't even get to go out on support of the new Tattoo album. That's when they got that drummer from L7, was it?
From Hole, I think.
Hole, yeah, Samantha Maloney.
Yeah. Yeah, so how old? I don't have down how old he was.
I think he was like 50.
Yeah, probably something like that.
Because he had been playing with Ozzy for quite a few years. I think he played with Ozzy for 10 years.
Yeah, he was No Rest for the Wicked. I think that was the first.
Yeah. Yeah, he was 51 when he died. He died in March of 2002.
Right. That was his first, like, the first time he really surfaced was with Ozzy, right? I don't know what he did before that. I can't remember.
He played on the Lita Ford album, Dancing on the Edge.
Okay.
But then he was on the, he was on, what, five or four Ozzy studio albums and a live album, from The Ultimate Sin through No More Tears.
Oh, he's on The Ultimate Sin?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So another thing, another kind of interesting thing that happened in between New Tattoo and Saints of Los Angeles was Brides of Destruction, which was
That was a super group, right? Wasn't like Duff McKagan involved with that? Or am I thinking of? I might be thinking of another band.
Well, it was Nikki and Tracy Guns. I don't remember who the other two guys were. At one point, Ginger from the Wild Hearts joined for like a month or something. There's this weird moment where Ginger joined the Brides of Destruction, but they had two records, I think.
Oh, John Corabi is a listed member.
Oh, was he in that at some point?
It says it, and also Ace Frehley's former drummer, Scott Coogan.
Yeah, that sounds right. It wasn't bad. It was a hell of a lot better than 6 a.m. or Methods of Mayhem, you know?
Yeah, they put out an album in 2004 and 2005.
Yeah.
And John Corabi on their first album is credited with a bunch of songs that he wrote, and then also additional guitars on all songs. We'll be right back.
So I'm not really sure how Tommy Lee rejoining the band went down or when it happened. But
yeah, I mean, well, at that point, when he did rejoin the band, they were pretty much just, you know, they had become a nostalgia act at that point, and they were just touring for the sake of touring. They weren't supporting any product. They weren't putting out new music. So it was just like, hey, a promoter is going to give us X amount of dollars to hit the road this summer or whatever.
Yeah, I guess.
So I'd imagine. Yeah,
I guess once Methods of Mayhem was a complete bust, and he had a there was also a Tommy Lee album, Never a Dull Moment. It's like these guys, they're never sensitive enough or they never understand sensitivity. Like a kid drowns in your swimming pool and then you're like, never a dull moment, you know? Yeah. I mean,
and then you put out a box set called Music to Crash a Car By.
Music to Drown a Kid By, they might as well put out next, you know? They don't understand. I know one thing I read is that they were supposed to do Ozfest and they couldn't do it because of Tommy, but then he went out on the Family Values tour with Methods of Mayhem.
With a Corn and it's like Biscuit was.
Yeah, it's so 90s. Ozfest, Family Values. It's like all this. Yeah. But yeah, Saints of Los Angeles. What the hell year did that come out now?
2008.
Yeah. I mean, why did they even. Like you That's said, what I mean. They didn't have a record contract,
so it wasn't like they had to fulfill an obligation or anything. And Nikki was doing 6 a.m. at that point. So was it just like, hey, the Motley Crue name still has some value? Let's try and, you know, tie it into the Dirt, which I guess they were trying to make as a movie at that point. And maybe they just thought it would be some extra promotion to sort of get some juice for that movie.
Yeah, it seems like maybe they were. You know, like they've come out with a soundtrack now. It's like maybe they were putting together a soundtrack thinking the movie was going to happen. And then when the movie didn't happen, they had all these songs and just figured they might as well put it out.
Yeah. I like the title track.
All right, here we go. Exactly. Our next guests have sold over 80 million albums worldwide, and their new CD right here is entitled Saints of Los Angeles. Please welcome back Motley Crue. Nick, how are you? Nice to see you. Vince, good to see you. Nikki, how are you? Thank you very much. Tommy, girls, would it kill you to wear a tie? Motley Crue, we'll see you tomorrow night. Thank you very much.
I think Face Down in the Dirt is all right, and Down at the Whiskey is kind of catchy.
It's got a good chorus.
Catchy. Yeah, it's catchy, but it's real generic.
Cheesy.
They accomplished the stupidest song title ever in the history of music. Chicks Equal Trouble.
Yeah, that's like one of the most uninspired, lazy songs that you can hear. And the fact that it took five people to write it, including Mick Mars.
How do you put out a song called that?
Well, I'm sure that title came from Mick Mars because he's been married, what, like five or six times?
Yeah.
Like that poor guy, like how many times did he make money and lose money and make money and lose money because of just poor marriage decisions?
Yeah. Yeah, he was, you know, yeah, we've talked about that in other episodes. Like the other guys squandered all their money on sheer stupidity. And Mick Mars was like not doing any of that, but he just lost it all to his many wives.
Oh, man. Yeah. And it, I was amazed to listen on the Generation Swine album that he became a grandfather during that album.
Yeah. Shandy.
This is like 22 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, he had kids back in like the early 70s.
Yeah. Yeah, he's the one guy that I've kind of wanted to hear from after the band, after the final tour. You know, he talked about recording a solo album, and I think he even talked about getting together with John Corabi, and it just hasn't happened yet. And I hope it does, because, you know, Mick is probably one of the most interesting guys musically in Motley Crue, and it kind of feels like we've never gotten to fully hear, you know, what Mick Mars is all about.
Yeah, that's true. That would be a really interesting thing to hear, is Mick Mars actually assert his own identity. You know, he's never done that, really. He's just always kind of been
going along for the ride.
Yeah, he's always just been in the background, like the secret weapon of Motley Crue. You know, it's like you almost forget he's even there.
Yeah. I really thought that they should have, when they made The Dirt, you know, Mick Mars should have been a CG character, because no person can play him, because he's just such a weird, unique looking dude.
Yeah, that's one problem I have with The Dirt, is the casting of Mick Mars, I think, is terrible.
Yeah, well, and the other thing about it is nobody looks like they're supposed to look. Well, Machine Gun Kelly, I think, really is the standout in that movie. I think he captured the essence of Tommy. He was gangly enough to sort of pass for Tommy. But the Nikki Sixx and the Vince Neil guys, they didn't sound anything like him. And like anytime you heard a voiceover in that movie, you had to really try and figure out who was talking, because their voices didn't sound anything like their real life counterparts.
Yeah, Vince Neil especially, I thought it was terrible casting. That guy's a good actor, but he doesn't look anything like Vince, and it just doesn't work. The whole time I was watching the movie, I was thinking, that guy just doesn't look like Vince. I couldn't get it out of my head. He doesn't work as Vince Neil. He just doesn't work.
After the fact, I looked it up weeks later, and I saw that he was Oswald in 11/22/63, and now that's all I see.
Yeah, I had looked it up while I was watching it. I always do that. I'm like, where do I know this guy from? You know?
You know what the funny thing about The Dirt is it feels like it was a vehicle to just really make Vince look like a great guy, because they make it seem like he's a great singer. When they find him, he's like fronting this basically this wedding cover band, and he's too good for Motley Crue. He's the one that says that Theater of Pain isn't really that good of an album. And then they really muck up him getting thrown out of the band or leaving. I mean, they really played with the timeline a lot in The Dirt, and it feels like they didn't need to.
Everybody, it's the same thing with Bohemian Rhapsody. People are like, it's not a documentary. But my point of view is, what is the point of making the movie if you're not going to stay true to the actual story? Otherwise, just make a fictional movie about a fictional band, and you can base it on whatever part of the Motley Crue story you want. But if you're going to make it about the Motley Crue story, then why not make it accurate? I don't understand that. I mean, I hated Bohemian Rhapsody. Hated it. And I like The Dirt more than Bohemian Rhapsody, just because I didn't take The Dirt seriously, I guess.
Yeah, The Dirt was a really easy movie to watch. I watched it twice. I mean, it's dumb entertainment, but like, you know, when you shoehorn in Doc McGee so early in their career, and they at least acknowledged how absurd it was, because, you know, Doc turns to the camera and says, yeah, this didn't happen. And they sort of fade out their original manager. I mean, at least they were acknowledging it, but like to just dismiss, you know, Vince's solo career, and then his daughter dying doesn't even fit with the timeline. And then Heather Locklear shows up way too early, and she's joking about Whitesnake before Whitesnake was even a thing.
Yeah, that's one of the dumbest parts. It was the same party where Vince killed Razzle that Tommy met Heather Locklear.
Yeah.
I mean, it's ridiculous. It's just like in Bohemian Rhapsody when Freddie Mercury stops at his parents' house on the way to Live Aid and comes out to his parents, and they give him acceptance on the way to Live Aid.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I got to make a pit stop to come out to my parents before I go to my triumphant performance at Live Aid. I mean, it's insulting.
Yeah. Well, and then also, there was some really funny parts in the dirt that were, I guess, unintentionally funny. Like, you know, they got like the goofiest looking guy they could get to play Karabi. And, you know,
yeah,
you know, it just looks like, you know, pick like a generic long haired guy off the street and just look goofy. And then also how they just make it look like they recorded Dr. Feelgood by themselves. Like Nikki's at the control board. No engineer, no Bob Rock.
Yeah. Well, they didn't have to pay an extra actor to play Bob Rock.
And have you listened to any of the new songs they did for The Dirt?
Yeah. Yeah.
They're all pretty forgettable, except for that that cover version of Like a Virgin, which really has no...
It's ludicrous.
Is there any reason for it?
I have no idea what the hell they were up to with that.
I mean, they're like... I thought maybe the movie would sort of make some connection, but the movie doesn't support it being on the album.
No, it makes no sense.
Yeah, I think the only really good thing that came out of the Dirt album, I don't even know if it's on the album, but there's that like really like slow female sung version of Livewire. You know, I think it's in the movie when like Nikki's shooting up or whatever.
Yeah.
The other thing about it is you've just got like the random Ozzy Osbourne scene that,
oh my God,
it offers nothing in terms of storytelling. It was entertaining, but it's not like they learned a lesson from Ozzy. It was just a scene to make it look like Ozzy was out of his mind.
Well, it's just like the scene that they decided to open the film with. It's fucking ridiculous.
Like, why would it matter if you nailed your door shut if you just left your window open? How does that prevent the cops from coming in?
I don't understand the casting for Mick Mars. They had such a great character, but it had to look right. They had to get somebody that looked right. I think it was so important to what they were trying to do. I don't know if they thought getting this horrible bad guy from Game of Thrones would be some kind of a selling point or something.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was so off that it didn't work because he needed to look a certain way. There needed to be a certain kind of a look to him.
And he didn't look older than them either.
No. You know, like they had to cast somebody who was like tall and skinny and lanky for Tommy.
Yeah.
And if they didn't, it just would have been totally off. And it's the same exact thing with Mick. They didn't cast the right kind of a look. I mean, it's the exact same thing. They needed a certain very specific kind of body type for Tommy Lee, and I think they needed the same thing for Mick Mars, and then it could have been an amazing character. You know, they had some good lines for him to deliver and stuff, but they fucked it up with the casting.
Yeah, there was no point where you were like, yes, that's Mick Mars.
No.
Yeah.
And Vince, too, they needed somebody with the right kind of a look. And, you know, they could have found somebody.
I do like that scene where Mick joins the band, though. And I don't know how much truth there is to that. I know the guitar player that sort of gets kicked out is a real guy.
Yeah, Robin. His name is Robin. Yeah.
But I just love how he can't play the riff. And then Mick pretty much just, you know, tells him to fuck off. You know, it's just a really funny scene. It's probably Mick's best scene in the movie just because he's so aggressive with the guy.
Yeah. They were playing the wrong song. They definitely didn't have Livewire at that point. but, you know, that's nitpicking, I guess.
Yeah. And then, I mean, it was weird too because, you know, Motley Crue did that whole publicity stunt where they signed a contract saying they would never tour together again. But The Dirt comes out, they record new songs for the album, and they're still technically a band. They haven't retired. They just have retired from the road, and now we get Mick Mars, or not Mick Mars, we get Vince Neil, you know, playing various festivals around the country, you know, sort of just creating YouTube clips for people to watch and laugh at. And Vince is playing a casino here in Vegas in a couple of weeks, and they have a no cell phone policy.
Really?
I guess so people can't take videos.
Yeah. I wonder why.
Have you seen that video where like they subtitle Vince singing?
It's Kickstart My Heart, right?
Yes.
Now I got a cop, heaven be a midnight, 103 in my heart. Ready, gals? Who ready now? Keep shining high, can't hit our back. Baby, yeah. Keep shining high. Peace in my heart. Too well in my heart. Looking for another good time. My heart. Yeah. Pretty. Yeah. Yeah. Hear the stage. Twiddle in the road. You hear my beat. And I say, we're still. Summer hot. Never stop. And I say, let it all. The two. Wow. Keep shining. Wow! 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 Always remember, we're Motley fucking Crew.
But it's so weird. Like, I mean, has any other band like done what Motley Crue did, where they just like they're like, yeah, we're not going to tour anymore, but we're not going to really be putting out active music, but we're not retiring. It's just it seems really weird to me.
Yeah, they'll probably tour again.
Well, I mean, the contract's not enforceable. I mean, who's going to enforce it?
Yeah.
The fans? I mean, like, seriously, I guess it just prevents them going out on the road with, like, if Tommy doesn't want to do it, they can't go out on the road. I mean, Tommy could probably enforce that contract, but nobody's able to enforce that contract. It was a great publicity stunt because Motley Crue played arenas again for the first time since – what in 20 years probably. I mean, that's how the final, you know, those farewell tours, you know, work. I mean, it's a cheap way to get extra butts in seats, but you know, you can only play it once or twice if you're Kiss. Well, they could reunite with Karabi and maybe get around it that way.
Yeah.
But really, I mean, is this the last formal release we're going to see from Motley Crue is, you know, the Dirt soundtrack, or
probably
do you
not.
Think that, yeah.
Don't you think that those guys could just do nothing and make enough money that comes in the mail or whatever to live
you'd
off
think
of?
So. Because it seems like their publishing was handled pretty well. It's not like Nikki took all the songwriting credits.
There's got to be enough money in Motley Crue to live a comfortable life without doing anything, I would think.
Yeah.
Even still.
Well, it seems like the one thing that you know, they've at least Nikki has sort of enjoyed being back in the spotlight, because you see all these like headlines about interviews Nikki's given where he's trashed somebody that, you know, had something negative to say about the Dirt, which, you know, it seems like Nikki and like Dee Snider are like two headline grabbers. They just love saying stupid shit to make, you know, to make it into, you know, onto websites.
Yeah, and they both have done that, have gotten headlines by talking shit about Kiss.
Yeah. Well, with Nikki, it's really rich because, like, you know, they toured with them. You know, there was obviously some kind of inspiration at some point. Like,
for sure.
You know, that seems the most, you know, at least with D, you can be like, you know, D is just being D. I mean, I don't think anybody really takes anything D says seriously, but like from Nikki, it just seems extremely hypocritical.
Well, D was right. What D said was that they shouldn't have Tommy and Eric in the Ace and Peter's makeup. That's all D said. And I agree with him 100%. So But, you know, Paul and Gene got upset. Paul. Paul was very dismissive and insulting towards Dee.
Too much. I mean, it's definitely, it's got to be interesting to be like a hardcore Motley Crue fan in 2019 because you're kind of just in limbo.
I don't understand the hardcore Motley Crue fans.
There's got to be them because, I mean, you know, I know there's people that have responded to your episodes here about, you know, I mean, there's passionate Motley Crue fans out there.
Yeah, people have asked me, why did I even do a Motley Crue series if I don't like Motley Crue? But I thought it would be interesting and entertaining. I do agree that it feels like it has gone on too long. So
yeah.
It's good that it'll be over. But you know, as a listener of the show, does it seem like it's gone on too long for you?
It definitely feels like Motley Crue has popped up in the Rock and or Roll feed for what, since February, I think.
Or March, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I always look forward to new episodes of your show, so I'm on board regardless. But if there were, like, two more Motley Crue episodes after this, the fatigue might have set in. But I got to say, BJ, that each one of these episodes, the guests you had on made it extremely entertaining. I mean, these episodes delivered exactly, I think, what you intended for them to deliver. And if nothing else, it exposed people to albums they might not have listened to, or, you know, sort of put albums that were held in a certain regard up to a microscope. Because, you know, I listened to the Theater of Pain episode and I was like, wow, I don't think it's that bad of an album. And then I listened to it and I'm like, nope, they were right. So, I love these album deep dives you do. I mean, you've done them with a couple of bands now, and it's cool. And I mean, you know, not having a new episode every other, you know, every week sort of made it feel like it went on forever. But bonus episodes.
Yeah. I think I made them entertaining. I put a lot of comedy into the Dr. Feelgood episode. I think that it was a really good conversation with Sonny and Steven for the 94 album. And I did my best with the edit on Generation Swine to make that entertaining.
So yeah.
I think they were all, even if you don't like Motley Crue or whatever, I think they were all entertaining.
Totally.
Yeah.
I'm sure I'll listen to some of those episodes again, you know, which is the best thing you can say about a podcast is when you listen to an episode more than once, it did its job.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of great little bits throughout these episodes. I had so much fun when Ryan McKay said that Raise Your Hands to Rock sounded like Feel Like Making Love, and then I mashed them up. Or I mashed I Want to Rock up with Feel Like Making Love. It was so much fun.
Yeah.
Or Without You.
And then you had
Chew.
Without You. Yeah, and you had that Van Halen mashup you did with Change.
Yeah. Change. Nothing stays the same. Yeah, so there's a lot of little fun stuff in the episodes to.
Yeah, I mean, you could probably make a full-length best of episode based on all the Motley Crue episodes.
Yeah.
You could call it Dirt, like the best of the Motley Crue episodes. It could probably be 2 hours on its own. I've talked about it before, BJ. You know, Rock and Roll is one of my favorite podcasts, and it's one I look forward to every time I, you know, see it come up in my feed. And it doesn't matter what the subject matter is, I'll listen to it. So it's always an honor and a privilege to be on your show. And I do want to take a moment, too, to thank you for including my CJ Ramone interview in the middle of all of this Motley Crue stuff.
Yeah, thanks for letting me. That was a good thing to be able to put out. It was great.
Sits down behind his drums, Nicky picks up his bass, and Mars plugs in his guitar. Something happens, man.
It's like a weird kind of electrical humidity. You don't just hear it, and feel it.
All I can say is, we fucking made it, dude.
I don't know how we're not dead or in jail. We shit on a lot of people and did things that we regret every day. And somehow, we're still here, in it together.
That's fate.
That's family. And that's Motley fucking Crue.
Back.